Hello, I'm Keith Parent, and welcome to Focus Asia Pacific. Coming up on today's program, China says it plans to reform its forced labor system, and it's welcomed by human rights groups around the world. Chinese journalists strike over a censorship row, and Burma urged to end airstrikes in Kachin State. We have this and more on this edition of Focus Asia Pacific, putting the focus on the Asia Pacific. Human rights groups have cautiously welcomed comments from a senior Chinese official that the government will stop using its so-called re-education through labor. The system is run by the police, and critics say it's used in part to punish dissidents and citizens who try to fight for their rights. Torture within the detention facilities is said to be endemic. Human Rights Watch and Amnesty International say an end to the re-education camps would be a positive move, but say there's a chance that any changes may be just cosmetic. Next, Ian Cochran speaks to Sophie Richardson from Human Rights Watch, based in Washington, D.C.
Official statistics suggest that at any given time, there are about 350 facilities in use that have incarcerated in them about 160,000 people. But as we know from a lot of different issues in China, government statistics are not always terribly reliable. So it is possible that there are both more people and more facilities than those numbers would suggest.
And what sort of work are people forced to do?
It's everything from manufacturing to labor on surrounding infrastructure projects. But to us, the issue is that it is forced, that people are not given choice. And I think it's very important that people understand that re-education through labor is a system that is under the control of administrative or police authorities in China, not the judicial system. So all of the people who are incarcerated in this system have wound up there without the benefit of a defense counsel, without access to the evidence that's presented against them, and without a decision being rendered about a sentence by a judge, right? So it is a profoundly arbitrary system of detention.
And that has given rise to quite a lot of discussion about the use of re-education as a form of reform or punishment, I guess. Can you tell us about some of the cases that have sparked public interest?
Yeah, there have been, we think that part of the reason that may have prompted today's announcement may be a response to rising public outcry over a couple of cases that became quite prominent last year. One of them involved a woman who, in pursuit of justice for the rape of her young daughter, was herself sentenced to re-education through labor and was released after she'd served about a week of that sentence because there had been such an outcry. But there was another case recently involving a very young village official who was sentenced to re-education through labor simply for wearing a T-shirt that had a phrase about freedom and democracy on it. That, you know, some of the people who are incarcerated in RTL have done absolutely nothing that's in violation of black-letter Chinese laws.
Now, the big shift has been the comments from Meng Jianzhu, the head of the Chinese Communist Party's Political and Legal Committee, saying that the system will be abolished or that the government will stop using re-education through labor. But is it clear what exactly will change?
No, it's not. And that's really where the concerns are still very real. We don't want to end up with effectively re-education through labor light, meaning a similar system that simply has a different name or some minor procedural guarantees attached to a system that still essentially is arbitrary. What we need to see is the wholesale abolition of the re-education through labor system. And so while we're certainly pleased to have heard this announcement today, we're still a long way away from anything meaningful really changing.
That was Sophie Richardson from Human Rights Watch speaking with Liam Cochran. Staying in China, journalists at the Southern Weekly, one of the most respected newspapers in the country, have gone on strike in a rare protest against censorship. The row began last week when the paper's New Year's editorial calling for constitutional reform was censored by propaganda officials. Furious, newspaper staff stopped work and demanded the resignation of the propaganda chief in Guangzhou province, where the weekly is based, and where hundreds of the paper's supporters scuffled with police. The far more conservative Global Times has published an editorial criticizing the weekly, which has been republished in newspapers across China on the orders of the Communist Party, prompting an outcry on Chinese social media. David Bandusky is the editor of the China Media Project at Hong Kong University, and he speaks next to our own Corinna Podger.
The original cause of this incident was a New Year's greeting that was published by Southern Weekly. Version one was a very strongly worded pro-reform editorial calling for civil rights in China and constitutionalism. The second version was the compromise version, as we would expect to see in China's media, that still sort of fit the Southern Weekly reform tradition, but was very much weakened in its tone. After the issue went to bed, as we say, after the proofs were signed off by the five editors who were working on it, I think that was 3 in the morning on January 1st, the two top editors were called in to the provincial propaganda office for a consultation over New Year's greeting. And after that point, there were changes inserted, so another version, that then were not approved by those editors. In addition to that, the Guangdong propaganda leaders added an introduction, so an entirely new text, and that actually contains some serious factual errors, including one about China's history. So this is a real intrusion on the editorial independence, such as it is at the newspaper, the kind that it had been used to having, and also on its reputation as a professional newspaper.
David, there was a protest on Monday against this alleged act of censorship, hundreds of people demonstrating outside the newspaper's headquarters in Guangzhou. Police allowed them to go ahead with that. Why do you think that was?
Calling it allowed is a bit touchy. You can officially apply in China to hold marches on various issues, but as far as I know, these are never approved. So, you know, this was not a welcome action. I think it was a surprise for the authorities. There's something that needs to be clarified. You know, maybe, hopefully it's not too complicated to fit in to your show. But Southern Weekly, this newspaper, has, as I said, has been doing some very strong journalism, as a number of Chinese newspapers have, within an environment of control. They live daily with censorship. They didn't just wake up that day and say, we've had enough, we're protesting. What really happened in this case is that the encroachment by propaganda authorities in Guangdong stepped way over the line of the status quo of censorship in China. In other words, there's a degree of space that media do have, and censorship has worked in a kind of consultative basis. So there's an interaction between propaganda leaders and editors. In this case, propaganda leaders went beyond the editors, and without consultation, they inserted content. And that's completely unprecedented, especially at a newspaper like this.
Now, this row has escalated every day since the article appeared on January the 1st, and you've been following support for the Southern Weekly's journalists on social media. What kinds of things are people saying?
Well, one of the things that people are objecting to vociferously today, especially, is an editorial in the Global Times newspaper, which is known as kind of a nationalistic pro-party newspaper. And it looks now that this editorial was forced into many newspapers in China by a directive from the propaganda department. That would be the central, the highest level propaganda department. And essentially, this editorial kind of brands the people who have supported the newspaper, Southern Weekly, as an isolated group of people supported by foreign hostile forces, as they tend to call them, and they don't really represent the broader mainstream view. And this has created a big backlash on Chinese social media. And one of the memes that we've seen today is comparing this propaganda and comparing this editorial to feces. There's been a lot of posts today. It's very interesting talking, for example, that Southern Weekly, which represents the strong journalism tradition, and Global Times are separated only by a piece of dung, if you will. But the difference is that Southern Weekly scrapes up the dung and Global Times eats it. I'm not just joking here. This has been all over the place. Mm. And there have been political cartoons posted on social media that liken propaganda to the feeding of feces to the population. So this all speaks to a very visceral sense of anger, I think, about the control of speech and about propaganda.
What kind of pressure does that put on the country's incoming president, Xi Jinping? He's coming into office having promised a more open style of governance in China.
Well, we in fact don't know exactly what Xi Jinping's vision is, and this is a real problem. I think in the last 2 months, since he became general secretary of the Chinese Communist Party, there's been speculation on the one hand that he might represent a more open policy across the board and be interested in reform. And in fact, when we did our reading of the 18th Party Congress at the China Media Project, our reading was very pessimistic. We saw nothing in Xi Jinping's statements to indicate that any sort of substantive change was on the way. And if you look at his speeches since the 18th Party Congress, I think that conclusion is still borne out. But what we have, on the other hand, is a concerted propaganda campaign that has tried through the state media to project this image of openness. But no one knows at this point. And the Southern Weekly case, this is really the first test of that ostensible openness that Xi Jinping has tried to represent.
David Brandusky, the editor of the China Media Project at Hong Kong University. The United Nations and the United States have urged Burmese officials to end airstrikes against the ethnic minority rebels in the northern state of Kachin. The attacks are understood to have begun several weeks ago, but the government only admitted to it after a humanitarian group, the Free Burmese Rangers, released a video of the aerial bombings to British journalists. The conflict is threatening to overshadow Burma's achievements on political reforms. We have this story from Kandahar Sapati.
The Burmese government is coming under increasing international pressure to halt its aerial attacks on the minority Kachin rebels. After 17 years of truce, the fighting with the Kachin rebels resumed in 2011 after the government and the Kachin Independence Organization and its military arm, the Kachin Independence Army, differed on the roadmap to peace. But the conflict escalated last month with the Burmese military on the ground, aided by army helicopters and jets, began firing on the KIA outpost in Lhasa, the headquarters of the KIO. Sidney Lazum, president of the New South Wales branch of the Kachin Association of Australia, has been in touch with people on the ground in Lhasa.
Every day, F-7 jet fighters, China-made, they call it Chindo F-7 jet fighters, and also Yugoslav-made G-4 Super Gallop jets, the training jet, they all have fire weapons, and they try to fire on all these KIA, posts. And in some cases, all these bombardment are actually directly hit to the civilian area. It's been happening almost every day. That's from the area bombardment. But from the ground force, the Burmese military, they are using the 105, 110, the mortar. They launching from 11 kilometers from the Lhasa area and randomly shelling to all these civilian populated area. That's what I heard from Lhasa.
According to sources in Lhasa, about 10 battalions, equivalent to a third of the Burmese army, are now in and around the Lhasa region. Sidney Lazum again.
So at the moment, the KIA, they're just, defending from the attack. They are not actually invading the Burmese military post or anything like that.
The government had earlier said that the military had not informed them of any airstrikes, just that they were told by the military that planes were being used to resupply its troops. But when the video of the aerial bombardments shot by the humanitarian group Free Burma Rangers was released to the BBC, the government acknowledged the strikes. So is the military working independently of the government, which claims to be all for political reform? It's a question I put to Nordin Lapai, the editor of the Kachin News Group based in Chiang Mai, Thailand.
The war is not necessary, this time, because this time is the time for political dialogue with not only the Kuching Armed Group, you know, the rest of ethnic armed groups. If government is implementing a genuine democratic reform, why, you know, they open the war against Kuching? This is a big question, you know. That's why it's clear the government is not implementing true democratic reform. They want to eliminate politically or militarily multi-ethnic armed groups.
Meanwhile, the situation for the internally displaced people, or IDPs, is becoming even more dire. There are some 50,000 IDPs in the state of Kuching, with some 10,000 of them in the Liza region. Moon Nae Lee from the Kuching Women's Association in Thailand says IDPs in Liza, which is KIO-controlled, are denied government assistance. Besides, she says, the government insists on the army escorting any foreign aid agencies into KIO-controlled areas, making things more difficult.
KIO already proposed and mentioned that don't come along with the communist troop. The reason is when they come with the UN agency, the troop is not go back to their area, just leave that troop very close to the KIO area.
The government says it's willing to start peace talks with the Kuching rebels once they have laid down their arms. But therein lies the problem, says Nordin Lapai.
KIO is always welcome dialogue and then talk. But this talk is not for disarm. This talk should solve the political root cause. But government always deny political problem between, you know, the Kuching and the government. So KIO, actually, they welcome peace talk. But peace talk must move toward political dialogue with not only Kuching, Kuching and other ethnic group.
And that was Kandahar Sapati reporting. You're listening to Focus Asia Pacific, a program that puts the focus on the Asia Pacific. Rightly or wrongly, Papua New Guinea's capital has long had a reputation as one of the world's most dangerous cities. Rampant crime has cast a shadow over its reputation, but now local authorities want to change that by installing security cameras around Port Moresby. The government wants to outsource minor policing duties to a private security firm, but there's only one problem with the radical plan. Police don't want it. We have this story from Papua New Guinea correspondent Liam Fox.
Unless you knew they were there, you probably wouldn't notice them. At the top of a tall light pole on the Poroparina freeway, two security cameras cast unblinking eyes over the flow of traffic. They're among a handful of cameras installed around Port Moresby as part of a radical plan to deter crime.
Anybody can do anything they want, anytime, any place. That's got to end.
One of the plan's main architects is the governor of the National Capital District, Powers Parkop.
We have to come up with some intervention that snap that mindset of impunity, especially our young men, to move away from a mindset where in the morning they think, I can get away with snatching a bag, I can get away with stealing a car.
The cameras that have been erected relay pictures to a control room in the local headquarters of the multinational security giant G4S. The company says it will notify police if it sees any disturbances or illegal activities, and the images can be used as evidence in court. But the governor's plan goes a step further. He wants G4S security guards to respond to minor incidents because he says police are not doing their job.
And in the city, we've got less than 1,000 policemen and women. In a city that is growing, that is expanding, the population is increasing. We are about 700,000 now. We could be in the next 5 years surpass 1 million.
The General Manager of Communications and Technology at G4S, Rob Andrews, says his guards would only respond to certain situations.
If it's general moving people on, chewing buoy in the wrong places, causing a commotion prior to some sort of incident, if we can predict that and prevent it, then we will dispatch our guards to get to the site as soon as possible. The idea is prevention.
But Mr. Andrews admits there's potential for his guards to overreact and assume the powers of police officers, particularly in tense situations.
That can happen, and unfortunately it does in some circumstances, and there's procedures in place that we have to use in terms of discipline and so on. But with the right trained personnel and with the video evidence, those sort of incidents will be minimised.
down at Gordon's Market, there's a huge array of fresh fruit and vegetables for sale. This is where locals do their grocery shopping, but it's also a magnet for petty criminals, pickpockets and bag snatchers. As part of the governor's crime crackdown, he wants to install cameras in hot spots like markets and bus stops. Stall holders and shoppers support the move.
Yeah, I think that would be a good initiative because currently at this time, our government didn't have any initiative to monitor the criminals.
Law and order in the country is a problem. I believe this initiative that the governor is taking, I think it will help to minimise the crimes and all in the city.
There's only one problem with the governor's plan, the police.
I won't be talking or I won't be cooperating or the police will not be cooperating with G4S.
Metropolitan Superintendent Peter Guinness says police were not consulted about either the installation of security cameras or the use of security guards. He says the cameras breach privacy provisions in the Constitution and recordings would not be admissible in court. As for the security guards, Superintendent Guinness says only police officers are authorised to enforce law and order.
And if G4S is seen to take over the duties and responsibilities of the police, they have committed an offence for creating an extraordinary police force in PNG.
New research indicates that the production of staple crops in India and China, two of the world's most populous countries, is stagnating after years of growth driven by the Green Revolution. A joint study by the University of Minnesota and McGill University in Canada calls for a renewed boost in investment in agriculture if the world is to meet the project for doubling food demand by 2050. Dr. Jijap Ray is from the University of Minnesota Institute on the Environment. He speaks to Tom Fail.
The top four crops of the world are maize, rice, wheat, and soybean. And in Asia, rice is a very major crop. The wheat is also a very major crop. And corn or maize is also a fairly major crop. So in these top three crops, what we found is there are large spatial extents in especially like the top producers of Asia where yields are not improving. They are basically stagnating now in the last, say, 10 years, 10, 20 years. They did improve post the Green Revolution years, post 1960s. But now in the last 10, 20 years, they seem to have just stopped improving their productivity.
So why is this happening?
Oh, there are a variety of reasons. And actually, there is no one particular reason in one particular area or even for one particular crop. It's just a whole bag of mixed reasons. And I think nobody is exactly sure of all the reasons possible or which is the dominant reason in each location because it's just so varied. And data sets to analyze such things don't really exist.
What's your best guess, though?
I feel from all that I've read and by looking at our maps, which may be considered as the final culmination of the final result of all these interacting factors which goes in. From all of that, it seems it's like we don't have good quality seed. There's not enough irrigation in many places. And the profitability in some of these crops have gone down or remained steady, whereas the cost for doing agriculture has gone up.
Then what can be done to reverse this trend?
There needs to be a lot of investment. So, for example, for better seeds, you need better research. And recently there was this outstanding paper from International Rice Research Institute from the Philippines, which figured out a new type of rice seed which can grow in, say, phosphorus-deficient soils. So there are problems like that, some very basic problems. So if you can develop better seeds like that and then it gets widely adopted in poor soil areas, then you will get better yield. So that's one simple thing, but requiring lots of research, obviously, behind it. Irrigation is obviously a very, very big factor in the drier parts, and for rice especially, and for wheat as well. And the cost of irrigation is just going up in many parts of Asia. So if the cost of irrigation goes up, you don't have better seeds, and the cost of fertilizer goes up, and wheat and the pest buildup takes place in your field, and the cost of pesticides goes up, then farming doesn't become so profitable. So farmers try to switch crops, or they just give up farming, I guess.
And for those who have grown up with the optimism of the Green Revolution, your research, I have to say, is a bit of a dampener.
The Green Revolution did very well for improving crop yields. And you know, the Green Revolution was primarily better seeds, more fertilizer, more irrigation. And that was the Green Revolution, lots of productivity. But to continue with the Green Revolution, you need to continue investing in the better seeds, more irrigation, right? If you don't invest in that, then the Green Revolution basically comes to a stop. It does not mean that the yields go down to where they were. That's like very few places in the world that has happened. Less than like just like 1% of maize and rice and wheat growing areas of the world. Everywhere else, yields improved, dramatically improved, doubled and tripled. But now no more in many areas. Especially the problem is in wheat and rice, not so much for maize and soybean.
Now, food demand is projected to double internationally by 2050. Will the world be able to meet that target?
That was one of the main driving forces behind this study. We wanted to do not just a global analysis, but actually try to figure out what is happening at the statistical division level in Australia, or like at the province level or district level in India. So you can actually make some effort to ensure that areas where yields are still improving, and mind you, there's huge tracts of Asia where yields are improving. It's not all doom and gloom. It's improving in vast areas of Asia, but then there are many other areas where yields are not improving. So the areas where yields are improving, we need to ensure that we continue on that track. Those areas don't falter. Like if you look at our high-resolution maps, you will see, for example, in Mindanao in the Philippines, the entire area is improving its rice yield, but it's just gradual. It's a very slow rate of improvement. So they're prime candidates now for reaching that yield stagnation level unless you do something to improve, to bring better technology, better fertilizer or better seeds to improve the yield faster. That was our target.
And with that, we've come to the end of this edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Before we go, I want to say hello to listeners of World FM in Tawa, New Zealand, who are now hearing this program for the very first time on 88.2 FM. They've just added this show to their schedule. So thank you very much, and hello to all the listeners down in New Zealand. You can check them out online at www.worldfm.co.nz. Anyway, that's all we have time for. We're going to end with a little bit of music today. The group is called Evoca. The song is called Starlight in Dadan. So until next time, friends, this is Keith Pallon wishing you well. Hope that you can join us again for another edition of Focus Asia Pacific. Bye-bye, everyone. I'm the girl who 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 I'm the girl